Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 100 years ago, one of the bloodiest and interminable struggles of World War I was playing out in Europe, the Battle of the Somme. Remembered as a brutal months-long battle of attrition by the German military against French and British forces, Somme also marked the first military use of the armored tank. The Great War introduced other technologies of war that remained part of our lexicon a century later. We'll talk about all of that today to acknowledge World War I during its centennial. We are joined by Ohio State University Distinguished Professor of European History and Associate at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at OSU, Jeffrey Parker. Welcome, Professor Parker.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Professor of International Relations at the University of St. Andrews and author of numerous books on World War I, Sir Hugh Strawn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
World War I is not as well understood by the general public as World War II, and there are differing opinions about the role of Germany in that war. Most of us know that it was triggered, this is what we learn in, you know, high school history, it was triggered by the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austria-Hungarian throne, and his wife. Sir Hugh, what's the generally accepted backstory to the start of the war?
This is a short program, and that's a long question.
We only have an hour.
Well, but you know, the assassination is still not a bad place to begin.
Okay.
Because you think about it. Your heir apparent is killed. With the complicity of an adjacent government, the Serbian government. And you think, too, that there is a possibility that that government will serve to undermine the integrity of what is still a multinational empire in the name of the Slavs, that it will create a separate Slav state, which is indeed what it will do after the First World War is over. And the decision taken very consciously in Austria-Hungary after the assassination was that the only way out of this dilemma was essentially what we would now call a limited war. That decision, which they follow through to the point of active hostilities a month later, is enough to trigger other tensions which with hindsight have much longer running causes and have been there before. But without that precipitant, it's hard to see that they would necessarily have led to war at that moment. I mean, I think that will be the current consensus.
Mm-hmm.
And what historians 30 years ago would have said would have been a bit different, because they would have said Germany was planning this war all along. They wanted the opportunity to have a war. The assassination provided that opportunity, and they pushed Austria-Hungary into it. The view now would not be there any longer. I think there are cycles in this,
mm-hmm.
We went through a period immediately after the First World War of German guilt, which came directly out of the propaganda of the war itself. By the 1930s, it had become accepted that, broadly speaking, Europe had, as Lloyd George put it, the British Prime Minister during the war had put it, Europe had slithered over the brink into the boiling cauldron of war. It was a failure, if you like, of the international system. Then in the 1960s, it swung back again to German war guilt. And we're in one of those moments when there's a degree of collective responsibility or irresponsibility which allows this limited war in the Balkans to escalate.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about it's the centennial of World War I, and I'm pretty lucky to have some special guests in today. Jeffrey Parker is a professor of European history at OSU, and also you just heard from Sir Hugh Strawn. He is World War One military historian, one of the best in the world. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Professor Parker, as I was preparing for the program, I was thinking, I was asking myself, ultimately, when it comes to the 20th century and the 21st century, what's more relevant? The beginning of the war, the beginning of World War I, or the end of World War I?
I think the end, because it solves so few of the problems. And
it was a failure, you're saying.
There's a famous cartoon done in 1919 at the Versailles Peace Conference, which shows the four major Allied victors coming out. And there's a small child with 1939 as a sash round its shoulders. It's crying. And the Lloyd George cartoon figure turns to Wilson and said, "I thought I heard a child crying." And so the cartoonist, like a number of people, realized that making Germany pay imposing a settlement as the Allies did was bound to have repercussions. So it's perhaps better to think of this as a 30 years war, which begins in 1914 and ends in 1944, 1945.
But it does sort of muddy the waters because there was the period of guilt right after the war that Germany went through. Was that more invoked more by having to pay the reparations and that kind of a thing?
The Germans certainly hyped the reparations. They paid very little of what was expected of them. Hmm. And they used their rejection of this idea of guilt as part of their justification, if you like, for not accepting morally accepting the terms of the peace settlement. But I think it's also, I think your original question goes to a very important point more generally, which is it's rather a lot easier to get into war than to get out of one. Hmm. And this war ends when? 1918, 1919, 1921, not in some terms up until 1923-24 because the Turkish peace settlement is not signed until the Treaty of Lausanne. So the war ends very messily in all theatres, and it's not just the war against Germany that ends messily and unsatisfactorily. Though we shouldn't assume that the Second World War is an inevitable consequence of that. I mean, I think I hope Geoffrey would agree, but one of the challenges I think for any historian is there any element of inevitability in this? There are far too many options in terms of what might happen in 1919 or 1920 for the Second World War to be the necessary consequence of the failure to get the peace settlement right.
How the war is commemorated during the centennial has been a bone of contention. Here, it's really not even a blip on the screen to a lot of people, and it's kind of interesting, but it's understandably a larger issue in Europe. And the countries aren't all on the same page when it comes to commemorating it. What's the problem?
I think there are two problems. One is, and you use the word commemorate, and I think that is an entirely right. I think that's the politically correct word to use.
Versus a celebrate.
But do you celebrate?
Yeah.
And for some countries, of course, there are things about this war to celebrate. It'll be interesting to see how the countries that achieve independence from, say, the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1918 treat the moment of national foundation. You know, Poland is once again back on the map after the end of this war, having ceased to exist for over 100 years. Czechoslovakia comes into being as a result of this war. Yugoslavia comes into being as a result of this war. So is, for those states or their successors, is this a moment of celebration rather than commemoration? Is a real question. I think the other challenge is if we simply use the word commemoration, is it simply to be understood in terms of the loss of a sense that this is a war that need not have been fought, of almost a suicidal gesture by Europe, which, having been, in inverted commas, at the center of the world in 1914, is not going to be when this 30 years war is over, as Geoffrey called it. I mean, that after 1945, clearly the United States and the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union will be the determining factor. So could have avoided all that. So that sense of opportunities foregone or of privilege foregone as a result of fighting a war that need not have been fought and fighting it in ways which were so devastating is part of what generates the uncertainty about whether you should even be commemorating it.
Hmm. Professor Parker, you were in France a year ago or a couple years ago when they, of course, were beginning to make note of the war, which lasted much longer for them, obviously, than the Americans. What did you notice about how they were commemorating, how they were remembering it?
I don't remember any commemoration of the beginning of the war, which was August 1914, so August 2014. The commemoration came on what we call Veterans Day, the 11th of November. And the 11th of November 2014 was a particularly moving commemoration. It lasted the entire day. But what struck me was the opening of a new monument near to Calais. Calais, of course, is very much in the news at the moment because of clearing the jungle. But it was in the news in November 2014 because there was a new circle of memory, Anneau de Mémoire, which was opened right by there. 300,000 bodies of those who died in the war was erected, but the names were in a single alphabetical order. The dead came from 40 different nations. They'd fought on both sides, and yet they were all commemorated together. And that was just an extraordinary gesture of commemorating the fact that this was a major human tragedy. It doesn't matter who won or who lost. They were all buried together, and all their names were in a single alphabetical order. I've never seen that elsewhere.
It's a wonderful memorial. And it
without reference to nationality?
Absolutely. Right. And it speaks to the power of this war, which is one of the benefits that's come out of it, the power of this war to create reconciliation. I mean, now within Europe, and perhaps even more specifically within Ireland, it has become a vehicle for reconciliation rather than for enmity, which has been, you know, I think there have been two great benefits to Europe from this commemoration. That has been one. And the other has been that it, from the purely historical point of view, it's been an extraordinary moment of public education. I mean, a four-year centenary, which is what it is for Britain or for France, is a long time. And both countries thought, how do we do this? We've never done anything like this before. France has commemorated 1789, has commemorated the French Revolution, but that's a single year. And the consequence of having 4 years is that you can essentially do it stage by stage. And what has been staggering to me is the public appetite and the public interest has continued to grow year on year.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there was a very low base point to begin with.
Right. Okay. So they're just they didn't know.
They didn't know. But it's also genealogy. People make connections. And because it's a global war, even immigrant communities to countries have a connection. You know, many people have felt, you know, this is not reflecting our society as it is today. And in narrowly national terms, that might well be right, simply because there's been so much migration within Europe. And clearly that point would apply to the United States as well. But the other side of that argument is because so many countries are involved in the war, because it does spread across the world, no part of the world is not affected in some way or other. Even neutral states are affected. And the result is that each family can make a personal connection back to this war. And so much of the initial engagement with it has been local rather than national. It's been about my family, my community, or my part of the world I come from, rather than about my country.
Yeah. We will continue our conversation. It is the centennial of World War I. It's a four-year period, and we're in the middle of it. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You just heard from Sir Hugh Strachan. He is a World War I military historian, and also with us, a OSU professor of European history, Jeffrey Parker. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A century ago, the First World War raged in Europe. The United States had not yet entered the war, and France was being clobbered by two extended battles of attrition, the Battle of Verdun and the Battle of the Somme. Both would end with millions of casualties. This hour, we're remembering World War I and how it shaped the 20th century. Still with us is OSU Distinguished University Professor of European History and an associate at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at Ohio State, Jeffrey Parker. Thanks again for joining us, Professor Parker. And I'm also Professor of International Relations at the University of St. Andrews and noted expert on World War I, Sir Hugh Strachan. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
You wanted to talk a little bit about how we commemorate, how we recognize World War I.
Yes, if you grow up in Britain or France, there are many, many monuments. And although it happened a century ago, there are still things that you can get to. If you drive through eastern France, there are villages détruits, a destroyed village, and all you see is acres and acres and acres of white crosses. So Hugh and I both have lived in Scotland, and there are small villages, very small villages, with the most enormous war memorials with hundreds of names on them. And you realize that not only did the men die, the village died. The community was destroyed by this. So you grew up in Europe with a very good memory, with a very acute memory of World War One. And I remember 1984, which was the 70th anniversary of the beginning of the war, Helmut Kohl, the Chancellor of Germany, and François Mitterrand, the President of France. Mitterrand, who'd actually fought near Verdun in World War II. Kohl, whose father had fought at Verdun. And they meet together to honour the opening of a new monument, the ossuaire, the ossuary where thousands and thousands of bones of both Germans and French are interred. And there's a moment where they reach together and Mitterrand puts his hand out. And Kohl grabs it, and they stand there for several minutes with their hands linked. And that's the beginning of a new reconciliation between France and Germany. It was what Sir Hugh was saying, that the war, although it divided initially, has gradually brought us together. This shared terror, this shared horror of millions of men and women being killed.
You know, we haven't talked a lot about the weaponry of World War One. It's certainly significant, and it makes you wonder if they had realized what they would bring about by having this war. Would they have gone ahead with it? The poison gas, the tanks, just the whole way that war was waged changed.
Well, they may not really have realized it on the 1st of August,
exactly.
But they certainly realized it by the end of August. My colleague Bruno Caban has just brought out a wonderful book called August 1914, in which he looks at the war in the first month of war in France. And in the first month of war, 50,000 men are killed. 50,000 men are killed in a week. 235,000 French soldiers are killed or missing in action in the first 2 months of the war. I mean, this is absolutely astonishing. And of course, everybody knows because the deaths are communicated by telegram. Some of the men who die form PALS battalions, as they're called in Britain. So you have whole streets who get telegrams saying, your son's dead. So it didn't take very long for it to sink in. But as Sir Hugh said, once you've started a war, it's very hard to get out of it.
Right.
I think, too, you need to – I mean, the weapons you're talking about, both tanks and gas, of course, are themselves product of the war itself.
Exactly.
So there are certainly new technologies before the war whose impact is anticipated but whose full horror is not realized because nobody's lived with it or lived with them on this scale. So that terrible experience. And in some way, I mean, August 1914 is one of the bloodiest phases, if not the bloodiest phase, of the war as a whole. I mean, more are lost in the opening battles of August 1914 than are lost at Verdun or the Somme, proportionately to the numbers who were put into action. And that is a consequence of attacking over open ground with machine guns, quick-firing artillery. These are all pre-war technologies which armies have recognized and which they know will cause heavy loss of life, but to which they don't have an immediate answer beyond, of course, the one they adopt very quickly, which is to dig trenches. You know, we think of trenches as horrible places, and undoubtedly they were, but they save lives. But it's the trenches that
they save lives, and they dragged out the war, though, too.
Well, but indeed they dragged out the war because they became inherently very hard to attack. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, if you hadn't dug trenches, are you saying would it just have become more and more bloody? I mean, you know, there is a reflection of there's a cause and effect here, which is very hard to, you know, you can't blame the trenches for dragging out
mm-hmm.
the war.
Mm-hmm.
The trenches are a consequence of the tactical circumstances in which you find yourself.
And the Germans very specifically intended it to be drawn out at a certain point in Verdun, right? Or was that
this
Somme?
Is a contentious
okay.
issue.
Okay.
But no, the Germans have no interest in a long war ultimately, which is the absurdity really of arguing that the Battle of Verdun was deliberately drawn out. Because if you look at once Britain's in this war, and even more when the United States is in this war, the economic balance is so firmly on the side of the Allies that there is no way that the Central Powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary, Bulgaria and the Ottoman Empire, can win. They can only win the war in short order if they're going to win it at all. And the paradox, if you like, of the German position is they have to try and win the war quickly because they know they can't win it in the long term.
David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi, pleased to meet you.
Hi.
I'd just like to talk to you, gentlemen. Earlier this month, I was in Tiep Ball and Vimy Ridge, Antony, and I had a chance to see the honoring ceremony for the 100th anniversary of the Battle of the Somme. And I've actually also been to Verdun and Beaumont-Hamel with the previous trip, because I have family who live in Amiens, which I'm sure you guys know about. The Somme River runs through it. I was interested in asking about how the Germans were able to integrate what would they call the stab in the back, that they were not defeated in battlefield. And even people like Ludendorff bought into this, even though he should have known better, because by 1918, it was obvious Germany was losing on the battlefield. I'll wait for that.
well, as you know, David, this is one of those big debates. Part of the argument was that the German army was losing on the battlefield, but it was still intact in the field in when the peace negotiations or when the armistice negotiations were begun. And, of course, it was still on French territory. It hadn't been driven back to France. And the Allies themselves didn't think they were likely to end this war before 1919, even allowing for the fact that they knew they would win it eventually, particularly as the US built up its strength and as US troops arrived in France. So for many, the end of the war in 1918 in France comes as a big surprise. And because it came as such as a big surprise, they're casting about for explanations. They look for rationalizations. And one of those is that the German army was not indeed defeated in the field, but collapsed because Germany collapsed at home, because there was revolution at home. And for me, that is a false antithesis. I mean, this is a country which is fighting what we would now call a total war, which is mobilizing as much military strength as it possibly can through conscription, which has mobilized its industry, which has mobilized the whole of society. And what happens at home and what happens at the front are indivisible. They're part and parcel of the same thing. So the absurdity of the stab in the back is that self-evidently the German army is suffering, but that is not to say that German society at home is not also suffering and that these aren't two sides of the same story.
David, thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate it. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. We have an email from Tom who says, several years ago, I received an email from a gentleman in the Netherlands. His family had adopted the grave of a World War I soldier from Pike County, Ohio, and he was interested in locating relatives. I was able to put him in touch with nieces and nephews of the deceased soldier through resources at the public library and even located a photo of the soldier in uniform at our local courthouse. It's touching to know that World War I is not forgotten. And the American role in it. And speaking of that, Bernie in Upper Arlington, you want to talk about that. Hi, Bernie.
Hi. Very nice conversation today. I'm wondering about the United States getting into the war. We really had no dog in that fight. We had no business being there. Somehow we turned the population of the United States against the Germans. They made up atrocities, and Wilson was supposed to keep us out of a war. He didn't. And this seemed to be, even though they had the Mexican letter, and they had the Lusitania, which sailed into a war zone, which was advertised they should stay out of the war zone, etc. There was a story that Churchill did not send out destroyers to protect the Lusitania because he wanted to get the United States into the war. What do these people think?
I think Jeffrey wants me to answer that question. I know that this issue of why the U.S. gets in the war is of course, one of the reasons why it's now so difficult for the U.S. to think about the war and to engage with it. And a lot of it depends on how you see Woodrow Wilson, doesn't it? Whether you see him as an idealist who has a vision of a better world order, or whether you see him as a man who fought the election on keeping in 1916 on keeping the U.S. out of the war and then takes the U.S. into the war. And I have to say, I tend to give Wilson the benefit of the doubt. I think what he's realized by 1917, particularly when he knows about the German plot to try and bring Mexico into the war and actually therefore to threaten the United States directly, particularly with the declaration of unrestricted U-boat warfare, which means that U.S. ships are going to be sunk and U.S. lives are going to be lost. So, you know, later than the Lusitania, which, of course, in 1915, he had resisted then the pressure to enter the war when the Lusitania was sunk. This time it's going to be much harder. I think at that point, Wilson realizes that if he really wants to have a role in shaping a better world, then he needs to be a participant in it, or the United States needs to be a participant in it. That if what will come out of this is an international order determined by what we would now see as liberal values, you know, thinking of you know, how America would see itself, then participating in the war gives you a seat at the peace table and the ability to shape what will then come out of it. And for all that what happens at Versailles, for the fact that Versailles proves to be a failed peace settlement, its principles are still the principles that the Allies are looking at in 1945 through the creation of the United Nations.
I think it's important to remember that not everyone in America is against the war. When Wilson gets Congress to agree to it, there's cheering and applause, and everyone in the capital is very happy. One of my doctoral advisees, Edward Gutierrez, has just published a book on the American soldiers who went to war and then came back. Every one of them is sent a little form, a military service record, and they're asked in 1919, so it's a sort of exit interview as they come back, and they're asked, you know, when did you volunteer? Why did you volunteer? Where did you go? Which ship did you go on? Where did you serve? But there's a fourth page on the questionnaires in which they're asked questions like, how did it feel to kill Germans? Do you have any regrets? What's your memory? And although all of them say it was a terrible experience, a large number, a surprisingly large number, quote General Sherman from Ohio, war is hell. They even say Sherman was right. It's the commonest single refrain. None of them say, I wish we hadn't gone to war.
An important distinction. Thank you, Bernie, for that call. Don in Granville, you're on the air. Hi, Don.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I've got a question. If we assume that the war was rather suspended rather than ended, I was just wondering how important was the influenza epidemic in 1918 in causing a cessation of hostilities, at least temporarily?
You know, it's a funny thing. It's one of the things that hasn't been discussed until recently. There's been a lot of new work on the influenza epidemic and also on the German army records about it. The German army keeps meticulous records. Every week they send in a Sanitätsbericht, a statement of health. And it lists the number of killed, the years for missing, who's ill, what they're gone down with. And the whole system breaks down in November 1918 because so many soldiers are going down with influenza. It's, in a way, it's more debilitating than having a soldier shot because you need four or five soldiers to carry the infected man out. And, of course, then they're going to get it as well. So the German army in November 1918 is suffering not only from defeat, the Allies are advancing against it very rapidly, a large number of German soldiers have mutinied, but an enormous number are going down with influenza. So I think it plays a very important part in Ludendorff's decision, in the German government's decision to surrender. They realize that this is an unpredictable enemy which is going to bring them down. I also think it's one reason why the Allies agree to an armistice, because, of course, it's affecting them too.
How much did the fact that it was so, it wiped out so many people so quickly affect the fact that we don't talk about it as much today? We don't have that much recollection of it in a way. It's sort of...
Well, and of course, more died through the influenza epidemic than died as a result of the war.
Right.
And it's often very hard to work out. It's one of the interesting things about the military casualties. As we were coming here today, Jeffrey talked about the numbers of military and civilian dead. And I said flippantly, we don't know how many civilians died. Not flippantly, genuinely, we don't know how many civilians died in this war. One of the challenges in looking at the military casualties of this war, which are given as 9 million thereabouts, we don't know precisely, is how many of those are deaths through battlefield injury And how many of those are deaths through disease?
There's no distinction.
There's no distinction.
Wow.
They died in uniform. They died serving their country, and therefore there is no distinction. And for 1918, many of those will be deaths through influenza. On the Western Front, it's staggering that there is not more disease. It shows how well military medicine's advanced, that men can live in such potentially unsanitary conditions and not suffer major disease, and do suffer overwhelmingly from battlefield casualties through 1914-18. As Geoffrey knows far better than I, disease was the bigger problem for armies, for every army really, up until the First World War, the bigger problem than battle.
Don, thanks a lot for that call. Once again, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or a comment. We have an email from Robert who says, the 1986 PBS broadcast, The Great War and the Shaping of the 20th Century, briefly addressed Archangel, a campaign I had not heard of until then. Could your guests please provide some details about Archangel? What was the purpose, Sir Hugh?
In 1917, Russia undergoes two revolutions, and as a result of the second one, Russia takes itself out of the war. The consequence of that for the Allies was potentially very serious indeed, because it meant that rather than fighting Germany and Austria-Hungary on two fronts, on the Russian front and on the French front, as well, of course, as the Italian front, but there's the Eastern and Western fronts, they're now confronting Germany on only one front, in addition to the Italian front. And the Balkan, sorry, the Balkan front, this is, it gets complicated. The East, but they're now fighting the Germans overwhelmingly on the Western Front. And what the Allies want to do is to try to reactivate that Eastern Front to make sure that the Eastern Front remains significant in the waging of the war. And they intervene on the side of the counter-revolutionaries, on the side of the whites, which they do, among other areas, both through the Baltic, through Archangel. So they continue that intervention after the end of the war, after the end of the hostilities against Germany. So in 1919, there are still British service personnel, for example, dying in Russia as a consequence of the intervention in Russia. And the United States is heavily involved in that intervention as well. So the intervention is what explains that, and it becomes a war against the revolution as much as a war to keep Russia in the war, because the war itself is over.
And not without success, because when Russia falls, Ludendorff had the option of moving all his troops from the Eastern Front to the West, but chose to go into Finland. Diverts a number of divisions into Finland, specifically to counter this British initiative at Archangel, which reduces the pressure in March 1918, which is as close as the Germans come to winning the war. They almost win it in August, September 1914. They come very close in March 1918. Hmm. And had those extra troops been sent to the West rather than to Finland, who knows what the outcome would have been.
We're talking about World War I. It is the centennial commemoration period of the war. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You just heard from Professor Geoffrey Parker. He's a professor of European history at Ohio State. And also with us, Sir Hugh Strawn. He is a World War I military historian, written many books on the topic. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A century ago, the First World War raged in Europe. The United States had not yet entered the war. and France was being clobbered by two extended battles of attrition, the Battle of Verdun and the Battle of the Somme. Both would end with millions of casualties. That's what we've been talking about today with my two guests, Jeffrey Parker. He's a professor of European history at Ohio State, and also Sir Hugh Strawn. He is a World War I military historian. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. World War II, as we mentioned earlier, saw a lot of firsts in warfare: tanks, trench warfare. We've talked about that. Poison gas was a big deal too, and also just the armor, just what they were able to, the guns, the firearms that they used were very different, very accelerated. And Jeffrey Parker, you have a segment or an excerpt from a book that sort of describes the damage done on that individual level.
Yes, I mentioned this is a book by my colleague Bruno Caban here at OSU on August 1914. And to begin with, the weapons themselves are not so surprising, but the damage that they do, especially, of course, to conscripts who've never seen conflict, is just dramatic. And they write about, they have a whole category called the Girl Cassé, the people whose faces have been smashed up by artillery. And some of them ask, you know, is it possible that a single bullet could have done this? But the horror of it has been recently confirmed as new motorways are built in northern France. They're excavated. And, of course, archaeologists go in. And I'd just like to read you this little passage from Caban's book. In the north of France, archaeologists have discovered that the bodies of World War I victims are often missing lower or upper limbs. This suggests that the soldiers were the victims of artillery fire, or that their bodies were ripped apart by a shell after their death. Some soldiers' legs have been found next to another body. The legs were all that remained. World War One, a century later, is still a way of getting you. In Britain, we had this fantastic display of ceramic poppies in the Tower of London, 8,800 of them, each for a dead Commonwealth or British soldier. And the cumulative effect of so much carnage, the red poppies out in the gardens of the Tower of London, was just absolutely breathtaking. You couldn't look at it and not be moved to tears.
Barbara in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My father, I am 89. My father was in the First World War, and he was gassed and shot at Verdun. He put his company, I'm a Canadian, he put his company together in Swift Current, Saskatchewan, when they did in those days, I think. And he was major, and he took his company. He was in the front lines with them in Germany. And when he was shot through the legs, his company, which he'd taken from Swift Current, carried him off the field. But he was also had poison gas. He lived to the age of 70, but from about 65 to 70, he had a debilitating disease that he lost feeling in his feet right up until he lost his voice. And we could just talk to him through his eyes, and they thought it may have been the effects of the poison gas. I didn't know if you had any information on poison gas, the effects of it in later years.
Well, I'm so glad you called, Barbara, because it was another issue I wanted to raise, was the issue of poison gas. Sir Hugh?
It's a very interesting and important question. I said just now that we know 9 million, or of the order of 9 million, military personnel died in this war across all countries. And normally gas is not seen as a principal precipitant of that death rate, because once antidotes were developed, then broadly speaking, gas could temporarily disable somebody, as they disabled your father, or they could blind people. But broadly speaking, most were seen to recover. What we now know, and people are much more conscious of, is the sort of experience that your father had, which is the long-term medical effects of gassing in the 1920s. I've spoken to other people like who have experiences and memories like yours, where they remember somebody living with the consequences of gas, and then raise the question quite legitimately, which is, did they die, in inverted commas, of natural causes, or did they die effectively because of war wounds? And there are other examples that can be even more specific than that. I was talking to somebody at home in Scotland about a year ago whose grandfather had been severely wounded as a Royal Flying Corps pilot, or RAF pilot, he would have been back then, a Royal Air Force pilot, because the Royal Air Force was created during the course of this war in April 1918, who was severely wounded, suffered from burns, was treated for those burns, lived beyond 1921, which was the cutoff point in Britain for saying whether somebody died during the war or did not die during the war, and died in 1925. Clearly, somebody who died in the war but is not deemed to be war dead. And exactly the same question might be asked about your father.
Barbara, thank you so much for that call. Dale in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Dale.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thank you.
First of all, I'd like to say that I consider myself very fortunate. I have a French ancestry on both sides. One came before the American Revolution, and one side came just before the French Revolution. But I'm sure that my ancestors fought in both wars. My question is this. You mentioned the Treaty of Versailles. In those discussions, the Middle East and Asia, parts of Asia, were divided up kind of randomly. And to quote the president in his first address, the quote, lines of tribe, where they took lines of tribe and basically lumped them together. How did the decision made at that treaty affect the current situation that we're living with in the 21st century?
Well, the Islamic State would certainly say, or Daesh would certainly say, fundamentally, they refer to the so-called Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916, the division between Britain and France about the division of territory in the Middle East, repeatedly. But there were many more factors that went into the eventual division of territory at the end of the First World War than simply that agreement. Some of which reflected the situation on the ground, including the military situation on the ground, and much of it affected, and I think we often forget this, by what you might term the wartime diplomacy itself. Remember, when this war was ongoing, the most important thing for every government engaged in it was the war. And there was a way in which the war itself and its immediate conduct trumped any consideration of what the post-war world might look like. It wasn't that they were totally unmindful of what the post-world war might look like, but compared with, for example, what happened in the Second World War, when there was very conscious deliberation about the post-war settlement and what it might look like, and how all sorts of problems which the war would throw up would be dealt with. In the First World War, this was the first time that something on this scale had been done. So commitments were undoubtedly made and entered into as a result of wartime necessity, which were essentially agreements between allies rather than anything to do with the enemy, in order to assure that the alliance held together, which had detrimental long-term effect. And the Middle East would be one of the most obvious examples of not quite a straight line, but a line from 1918-1919 to 2016.
Dale, thanks for that call. I want to turn to Rosalind now in Dayton. Hi, Rosalind. Hello, Rosalind.
Yes?
You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh. Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead.
My uncle was in the First World War. His name was William Hugh Kendall. And he wrote a letter to his sister Dorothy saying he was going to move forward with his, I want to say squadron or group, and they were going to fight the Germans near France. And then they got a message saying that they didn't need to do that because the Indians had taken care of it. And I was surprised when I read that because I hadn't really been aware that the Indians and Commonwealth people were in the war on the British side. And as you were speaking about earlier in the show, that there were a lot of other people from around the world that were fighting on the side of the British, and I would like them to be remembered. My uncle, William Hugh Kendall, was killed at 19 years old before the end of the war. Thank you.
Thank you, Rosalind.
I think you'll find that in the ceramic poppies that were put around the Tower of London in 2014, I happen to have got the figure here, it's 888,246, and it's one for every British and Commonwealth war dead. So they were remembered. They are remembered. It's funny how these things stay with you. I watched a programme on my favourite comedy show, which is Blackadder, which was filmed in 1989. The fourth and final episode was about World War One, and right at the end, it's funny about life in the trenches. It's all about jokes. But the last 5 minutes becomes very serious because suddenly Blackadder and his friends are caught out in the war and they have to go over the top. And the last 5 minutes are very gripping. And the last shot of the series, the last shot of the last episode, shows them coming out of the trenches, and they're all shot down within seconds. And the producer said to Rowan Atkinson and the others, OK, that was good, but we'd like to do another take. And apparently there's a long silence. And the four actors say, no, we can't do that again. We can't do it. And in fact, one of them said, you know, I just burst into tears afterwards. So even, as I was saying, even all this distance of time, the inhumanity, the terrible things that men and women went through during World War One, they'll never leave us.
Robert in Columbus, you're on the air.
Hi. I read a book a few years ago by Max Brooks called The Harlem Hellfighters, which really exposed me to a part of World War One I never knew about, was that there was a black unit from Harlem, New York City, and they went, were trained by the French, fought in World War One, came back home, and really didn't receive the recognition or benefit until recent years. I was wondering if your guests can speak on that.
Sir Hugh?
Well, the treatment of black soldiers who served in the U.S. Army became a big issue after the war, absolutely, because they did not get the recognition. And one of the challenges is it actually relates to the previous call about the Indian experience of the war.
Asian Indian.
Well, Asian Indian,
absolutely,
absolutely
clear, yeah.
Yes, not North American.
Right.
The Asian Indian experience of the war, which was that going to France, both these countries, the United States and India, experienced very different racial attitudes from the racial attitudes they had encountered either in India or in the United States at the time. The Indians recall how well received they were by the French. There was tremendous adulation. They landed at Marseille, so they came right through the country as they moved north in 1914. And the Indian cavalry especially attracted French attention. But it was striking to them how intimate, in some cases, I think with some of the French women, perhaps too intimate, those relationships became. Black soldiers serving the U.S. Army had a very similar sense of acceptance and involvement with the French people, which then provided a striking contrast to the return home and the sense that they were still being discriminated against when they returned to the United States.
It's interesting to think about people going off on their own to fight with the French in World War One. The Harlem Hellfighters weren't the only ones that did it. And the same thing happened in World War II, as a matter of fact. Before the Americans got into the war officially, Americans would go over there.
But that brings back to the point that something Jeffrey said before, which is that many identified with this cause.
Yeah.
Many believe this was an important cause to fight for. And I think as we reflect on this war, there are really two points that seem to be important. One is, because we see the Second World War particularly in the United States, as the good war, we can so easily dismiss the notion that this could be seen as a good war at the time when it was being fought. And for many, it was a good war. It was a war about fundamental beliefs, about treaty law, about liberal values, a war against German militarism. Doesn't mean that it wasn't seen as equally important on the German or the Austro-Hungarian side for the converse arguments. So it was seen as a good war in many respects. And secondly, it's also important to remember that despite the loss of life in this war was considerably less than the loss of life in the Second World War. Hmm. Not true for Britain and France. We've talked a great deal about them, and their loss of life in the First World War was greater than in the Second World War. But for every other belligerent of the First World War, the experience of the Second World War would be far more awful. But we think about it less because we still validate the reasons for which the Second World War was fought in a way we don't validate the reasons for which the First World War was fought.
Stu Husteron, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Sir Hugh Strawn is a World War I military historian. OSU's Department of History is hosting a symposium called The War to End All Wars, U.S. National World War I Centennial Symposium, 1916 to 2016. It starts this evening. For more information, you can check out the link at our website at WOSU.org. And OSU Professor of European History, Jeffrey Parker, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All Sides interns Walter Hopp, Jessica Shakespeare, and Shelby Powers, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.